Welcome to the program. It's one of the most fundamental yet controversial questions of our time, perhaps of all time. How did the universe begin? The world's most esteemed physicist, Stephen Hawking, once said that if we understood all the forces that created the universe, we'd understand the mind of God. Now Hawking and his co-author, our guest this morning, Leonard Mlodinow, argue that the universe could indeed have created itself from nothing. This means that perhaps other universes were formed before the Big Bang and that others came after. We're going to talk about all of this today with my guest, Leonard Mlodinow. He's a teacher, a physicist at Caltech, the best-selling author of the previous book, The Drunkard's Walk. It is my pleasure to have him here to talk about The Grand Design, which he co-wrote with Stephen Hawking. Leonard Mlodinow, thanks so much for joining us.
Nice to be here, Jeff.
It's good to have you here. What's changed since Hawking's first book, since A Brief History of Time? What do we understand now about physics, about cosmology, that is different?
Well, the whole world of cosmology has changed since then. It's gone many changes. Probably the most significant new data is coming in from detailed observations of what's called the cosmic microwave background radiation. That's a mouthful, but we can call that the CMBR. And the CMBR is really just the afterglow of the Big Bang. And it's cooled down now to about 2.7 degrees Kelvin, that is 2.7 degrees above absolute zero. And it's almost exactly the same temperature in any direction that you look at. But if you look at an extremely fine resolution, you'll find that there are fluctuations of about a part in 100,000. And it's these fluctuations and other properties of it that we're just starting to access now with our space satellites that really give us a good view into the Big Bang, into the early universe. And the other important thing for our book that has occurred is that in the last five or 10 years, Stephen has come up with a new approach to cosmology that he calls the top-down approach. Now, his original book, A Brief History of Time, was based on his so-called wave function of the universe and the no-boundary condition. And the no-boundary condition said that when you go back in time far enough, you know, as the universe is getting smaller and smaller and smaller, all the matter is getting packed in really tightly, then when you look at Einstein's theory of gravity combined with quantum theory, we learn that time becomes like another direction of space. And that's because Einstein's theory tells us that time and space are not fixed as Newton had thought, but they actually interact with what is in it. They interact with the matter and energy in it. And in matter and energy, in turn, interact with the time and space, and it all is coupled together. And when you go back to the early universe, then time begins to behave like another dimension of space, and it loses its character as time as we know it. And that was the no-boundary proposal, and that was the subject of A Brief History of Time. Now, his new idea, the top-down cosmology, which he adds to that, is the idea that people haven't been doing cosmology quite right, in his opinion. The normal way of doing cosmology, first of all, is classical. We call it classical or Newtonian, and that assumes that the universe has a single well-defined history. Of course, that's what we find in everyday life. Billiard ball rolling down the table has a well-defined history, and the ball is at some given place in time. At any time we look, it's going to be at a given place, and it's going to have a certain velocity, and our measurement is simply learning information about where the ball happens to be anyway. In quantum theory, that's not true. It is not right to look at objects as having those properties, as those properties being defined for objects when we're not actually measuring them. So a quantum billiard ball, it's not right to say that it has a position at all times and we're just learning that position, but we're in a sense forcing it to make a commitment on a position when we measure it. And in between, it has no position, has no meaning. In fact, it has no single path or history, but it has many histories. So the top-down approach to cosmology says, number one, that the universe has many histories because it's a quantum system. And the other part of top-down cosmology is what the name comes from. That refers to the fact that people generally, in cosmology and in physics, in a physics experiment, you set up an experiment, you set up certain initial conditions, and then at some later time, you take a measurement and you compare what you measure to the predictions that you would make based on the initial conditions and the theory moving you forward in time. But in cosmology, we're part of this experiment. We can't set up a laboratory experiment. It's not We have no control over the initial conditions, and we're part of it. So all we can do is make the final measurement. So Stephen says we should take the measurements, the observations today, and work our way backwards. That's why it's called top-down as opposed to bottom-up. So he's combining the top-down proposal with the no-boundary condition in our new book, and we also talk about M-theory, which was developed in the mid-90s. And these three ingredients together give the picture that we describe in our book of how the universe was formed and why the laws of nature are what they are.
Going back a bit here in terms of talking about the laws of nature, talk about the way this theory, this top-down theory, has been able to couple in ways that heretofore haven't really worked the idea of relativity dealing with large objects and the idea of quantum mechanics dealing with the very small, and how the laws of both have been able to be reconciled in the context of this theory.
Well, that's been the big puzzle in physics since Einstein came up with general relativity in 1916. And, of course, quantum theory was developed between 1900 or so and 1925 and 1927. Those two theories seem to have a conflict. And even though Einstein was one of the actual founders, in my opinion, he was the most important of the founders of quantum theory. I mean, one might argue that Max Planck, who first discovered the quantum, was the father or the parent of quantum theory. But Einstein in 1905 really was the first to take it seriously as a physical principle. And yet, when he developed general relativity, it was what we call a classical theory. Everything had a single history. It did not have many histories as things do in quantum theory. And he never really accepted his child of quantum theory. He always thought there'd be something else must be at work behind it or beneath it that was really classical, so that all this quantum indeterminism was hard for him to accept. And ever since his theory, people have been trying to reconcile quantum theory and gravity, because if nature is quantum and all the other forces of nature are quantum, how could this force have different reality, you know, than the other forces? And Stephen's life has pretty much been dedicated to that question, to reconciling quantum theory with reality and applying that to situations such as the beginning of the universe and black holes. And so these latest ideas are just an outgrowth of 40, 45 years of his work to understand that.
And part of what you and Hawking argue in The Grand Design is that it is precisely this idea of gravity that could have allowed the universe to create essentially spontaneously.
Right. So the first ingredient you need for the spontaneous creation is the quantum idea, because one of the weird ideas of quantum theory is that there's no such thing as nothing. Nothingness is really some kind of boiling soup of things coming in and out of existence. And that might sound strange, but it's an implication of the theory that has been tested over and over to 10 decimal places accuracy, and it's one of the most tested theories in all of science. And so it is the way nature behaves, that a vacuum has fluctuations, we call them. And the other ingredient is that the energy, what's going to happen depends on the energy balance. And it happens that with a law like gravity, matter can be created without any energy cost, which is very important. And that's because, of course, matter has energy, as we know from Einstein's theory of special relativity. So you can't just create matter from nothing. But it turns out that that gravity has negative potential energy on a global scale that can balance the positive energy of the matter within the universe. And so this energy balance is very important in the creation of universes. And the creation of a universe is, in some sense, free because of gravity.
Talk a little bit about this idea of a multiverse, which is also a part of this.
Well, when you put these ideas together, quantum theory doesn't just predict that one universe will pop up, the specific one that we have. It predicts that many, many universes will pop up, zillions of universes, to use a technical term. Furthermore, they all have different physical laws. So the laws of nature, for instance, the Earth pulling on us in this universe, in another universe, it might pull on us 10 times as hard. I have to be careful. Don't take me literally if you're a scientist or a physicist when I say that, because the physicists will know that if gravity were 10 times as strong, the universe would not be the way it is today. It would not have evolved and developed as it is today. And that's an important point. In these other universes where the laws are very different, of course, the universe you end up with is very different. The evolution of the universe is very different. There may not be stars, for instance, or there may just be one generation of stars before the universe just collapses, or all sorts of things can happen. There may be that the heavy elements that we're made of, carbon, oxygen, are not created as they are in our universe inside stars. Perhaps this changing the laws spoils that. And then there's a lot of elements, a lot of steps that go into the fact that we are here today. And if you start trying to be the intelligent designer and tweaking these laws, you'll find that it's very hard to tweak them very much and still allow complex beings to exist. It was really a great mystery of science, something that people haven't thought about too much until the last couple decades. But the multiverse explains that, because it's no longer such a great mystery that we live in this finely tuned universe when you realize that many, many universes exist and they all have different laws.
You mentioned M-theory a little while ago. To a certain extent, it is an extension of string theory. Talk a little bit about that. Explain that a little bit.
Well, so Einstein not only wanted, of course, to get rid of quantum mechanics, but he wanted to find what he called a unified field theory. So he wanted to explain all the forces of nature and unite them with his gravity, because, you know, his theory involved only one of the forces, and there was another force, electromagnetism, that was known at the time, and that was not included in his theory. And then in the 30s, physicists discovered two other forces that are act inside the nucleus, the strong and the weak nuclear force, and all these Einstein felt should be united in one theory. And that's another thing, other than trying to unite quantum theory and gravity, physicists have been trying to fit the other theories into one theory. So in the 1980s, well, actually it started earlier, but in the 1980s, a lot of progress was made on these theories called string theory, on a type of theory called string theory, which was an attempt to form a quantum theory of gravity and the other forces of nature as well. Unfortunately, during the 80s, it turned out that there were five different string theories and no way to pick among them. So we had this embarrassing situation where we want a single unified theory of these four forces, and we end up with five unified theories of the four forces. And you think, gee, maybe we should just have one theory for each. That even sounds better. And on top of that, there was another theory called supergravity in the mix, and people were just a little bit confused about how these things relate to each other. Then in 1995, it was realized that really a beautiful thing that each of these theories, each of these five theories plus supergravity, are all different aspects of a greater, more fundamental theory. And that's what's called M-theory. And no one even, M-theory is very mysterious. We are still trying to find the properties of M-theory and how it relates exactly to those other theories. But we don't even know where the name came from, because it somehow came into common usage and no one remembers what the M stood for. But Stephen believes that M-theory is the fundamental theory that Einstein was looking for, and in fact that it's the only theory that will give finite predictions and include quantum gravity in it. So, and that's the theory that we use as the third ingredient in this book, in addition to Stephen's theories, the top-down cosmology and the no boundary condition.
And how are we going about beginning to validate these theories?
Well, the cosmic microwave background radiation, which is the afterglow of the Big Bang, and the fine points of the cosmic microwave background radiation really will distinguish between these theories.
Talk a little bit about these theories and how they have progressed over the past years, how we have begun, based on the science that we have, to understand more and more about these various aspects we've been talking about.
First came Newtonian physics, and it was really the physics of everyday life and the physics that can be measured directly by your eyes and your ears. And that corresponded very well to our intuitive idea, and it gave an idea of reality that was very intuitive. And then came this revolution of relativity and quantum theory, and then came the period of trying to combine gravity and quantum theory. And then, you know, largely due to Stephen and some others like Roger Penrose, people started applying these ideas to the whole universe, and that was in the late 60s and the 70s that was first started. Before that, Everyone thought that people who thought about beginning to use were kind of nutty. I mean, you can't do an experiment, obviously, on that. They thought that you would never be able to measure anything because the idea of measuring the cosmic microwave background to that accuracy seemed unfathomable. And, you know, it just seemed irrelevant to everything. And really, Stephen and some other people started showing the relevance and, for instance, showing the connection between black holes in the early in the beginning of the universe and how you can learn about one of these very important issues, quantum gravity, by considering what happens, say, outside a black hole. And that was the evaporation of black holes that Stephen developed. And he realized that by looking at these extreme situations, we could actually learn a lot about the theories that we're really interested in. And gradually over the decades, it became fashionable to work in that field rather than very unfashionable. So that's a lot. And physics has a lot to owe to Stephen for making that that area of research something that was mainstream.
This book certainly has created some controversy, particularly in its reaction from religious leaders, based on this idea that the universe, in effect, can create itself, that it didn't need the hand of a creator. Talk about that controversy.
Well, first of all, there's been a lot of ad hominem attacks, and there's been a lot of exaggeration and a lot of people commenting on things that they claim we said in the book that we didn't say, and they obviously, a lot of them haven't read the book. There was a baroness in England from the House of Lords who said that scientists should keep their nose out of physics and compared us to the Taliban, and I just think these are all silly and unproductive histrionics, and I just don't understand where they're coming from. I understand people might feel that their beliefs are threatened, but if they actually read the book, they'll see that we don't say that the universe wasn't created by God. We said God is not necessary. The answers that we give to why the universe was created and why the laws are what they are show that physics can explain it. So you don't need God, but we definitely stop and not say there is no God and not say God did not create the universe. Don't say that we give a proof that there is no God. We're just giving some information from modern science, and they should just get over it, you know, this feeling of being threatened. If people are people of faith, they will continue to believe as they have over the centuries. And the fact that you don't need it because of our technical physics explanations isn't going to shake people's faith. And I think they're worried and they're overreacting, and it's just childish.
And to a certain extent, I mean, it makes the powerful case that, in fact, religion, God, whatever we want to call it, is more a creation of man and not necessarily having anything to do with physics.
Well, if there is a God, I don't think God needs them to rush to the defense. I don't know why through the ages people have, used coercion to and now ridicule to defend their God. It would seem that God should need no such defense.
But the truth is that whether it's Galileo or Newton or anything else, these are debates that have been going on really since the beginning of science, between the beginning of cosmology and astronomy.
Right. The only difference being that I would hope in our civilized society today that people are no longer burnt at the stake or put under house arrest for espousing ideas such as this. We'll see.
Coming back to these ideas, what is the next step? What is now the cutting edge of where you or Hawking want to go in terms of understanding all of this? What's the next plateau?
Well, the details of the theory need to be worked out. Experimental tests need to be worked out from the theoretical side and from the experimental side. And I think that the real key to pushing forward cosmology now is the new Planck satellite, and there's a new satellite that was launched to observe the cosmic microwave background at an even finer level, and another satellite, its successor is on the drawing boards. And we might get some great surprise from the LHC in Geneva. We have our fingers crossed that there will be some new physics coming out of there. But one never knows.
What do we expect to find from that? What might we be able to tell from that?
Well, the LHC was designed primarily, or one of its central tasks was to detect something called the Higgs boson. And in the modern theories of all of the forces of nature, that's a very important particle, because the theories are dependent on certain symmetries being true, and those symmetries are spoiled if particles have mass. But of course, we observe that particles have mass, and the Higgs particle is an answer to that. With the Higgs particle in the theories, the symmetries can be there, and particles can still have mass due to their interactions with this Higgs particle. So right now, though, the Higgs particle is just a theoretical construct, and people have various arguments for what its properties should be, and they believe that it really ought to be detectable by this machine at the LHC in Geneva. And so if it's not detected, that would cause a big stir. It will either require a major revision of our theories, some people will argue that the arguments that about why it should have been observed were wrong, and it's really heavier, let's say, than we believed it was, and is somehow outside of our grasp. And so we'll see what happens. But that's the biggest, the central figure in the LHC. But there's a lot of other things that could be observed. Some hope to observe dark matter. It's also possible that these mini black holes will be observed, which would be great, because then Stephen could get his Nobel Prize. Because, the Nobel Committee is a bit odd that, I guess they don't give a Nobel Prize until something is experimentally confirmed, which I suppose makes sense. And then they tend to give it to the experimentalists, though, and not to the theorists. In fact, Penzias and Wilson, who discovered the cosmic microwave background radiation accidentally, without knowing what it was, got a Nobel Prize. But the theorists who had previously predicted that it would be there, and the theorists who explained what it was when they found it, did not share in that prize. So that was too bad.
And finally, talk a little bit about what it was like, and you've done this before, working with Hawking.
Well, we first worked on a briefer history of time, which was an attempt to make the brief history of time more understandable and simpler. It's fun. It's fun. He's obviously brilliant. He's really stubborn. He said his stubbornness is both his biggest, worst point and his best point, because obviously both for physics, theoretical physics is so difficult, so takes so much concentration and work that you have to really be stubborn to succeed. And and also with his disability, I think he needs to be very stubborn to keep pushing forward, even with his communication difficulties. So he's a stubborn fellow, but he has a great sense of humor. He's warm, and it was a pleasure working with him, even though it took us 4 years to get the book done. He comes to Caltech every year for about a month or 6 weeks, and I went to Cambridge several times a year for extended periods, and we would just sit together and hash it out, and then in between we would each do work and send it to each other.
Given that it took 4 years to get the grand design done, during that four-year period, were there changes? Were there things that shifted in terms of either the science or yours or Hawking's theories about any of this?
Well, especially in the beginning when he was still working out the top-down approach. There was one funny scene where we argued for about an hour over this paragraph, and I was sure that the paragraph was right, and he was sure that it was wrong. And I went back and in my laptop as he was composing some comment, and I found the origin of, because I was saying, how could I have gotten it so far off? How could I be so misunderstand it? And I found he had written it himself. So I said, Stephen, look, you wrote this yourself. And he says, it's still wrong. I changed my mind. So there were those moments, yeah. But toward the end, I think things, the first couple of years, there was a little bit of flux in some of the ideas, and then I think he was working them out all as we were going, and it pretty much crystallized for him, I think, about halfway through the book. And there were many other aspects of the book, of course, than that we were working on all along as well.
Leonard Balodnow, the book is The Grand Design. He's the co-author with Stephen Hawking. Leonard, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you. It was fun.
Thank you.